Dear brothers and sisters in Christ, and everybody else here that has come here, I think we could all agree that it is a very nice day to be here. Not only because of the nice weather and good fellowship, but because of the Word of God. And that's why we are here. And we are hopefully getting some very good lessons from the class that we've had related to Daniel and all the chapters and days that we've covered. And I was trying to come up with some very general description of the book itself. And I've came up with three things that I think would describe the book, and one being miracles, because we saw miracles related to the fire when the three children or young men were cast in. And we saw the miracle related to Daniel as he was protected from the lions. And then you have the prophecies, which we've dealt with, in which you have many signs of the times, and many measurements that some have been fulfilled and some are still to be fulfilled, which in a sense confirm that what he has said or what he has written is sure. And then thirdly, we have Daniel's character, which I think has been brought out very well this week. And I have for sure learned some things related to Daniel that I may not have known before, or at least saw him in a much, much better light as far as his character was concerned. And I think this chapter will deal even more with that character as we get an opinion from the angel. And that's the thing I think Brother Fred brought out, in which he calls him a man greatly beloved. So that's a very good standing to be in related to the angel. So, Lord willing, we will continue and have this, make this a very good class as well related to the study. Now, related to a specific chapter of chapter 10, two brief general comments related to that chapter. It seems that chapter 10, chapter 11, and chapter 12 are really one. And you can pretty much say that chapter 10 is sort of like the introduction or the prologue to chapter 11, which is the main emphasis related to the this event in which the angel comes to Daniel. And then chapter 12 being sort of an epilogue of the 11th chapter. Now, in this chapter are some unique features that I think we will derive from, and we'll get some insight into how things work that we may not be so aware of around us. And so there are three things that to keep in mind as we go through the chapter. One is the ways of providence. The other one is free will. And the third being angels, which I think Brother Matthew covered last night, so I may cover a little bit of what he went over. But think about those three things: providence, free will, and angels. And then think about the interrelation of those three and the very, very, very complicated way in which those three things have to deal, have to be sort of worked out by the angels or deity. So that's something to keep in mind as we go through this chapter. Let's look at verse 1, and there are some interesting points to be made related to that. This is the final vision that Daniel is going to receive. And again, we're talking about chapter 10, 11, 12. And it says in verse 1 that it was given to him in the third year of Cyrus. Which, again, not to get too dogmatic on dates, but we're talking about maybe 540 to 536, for let's say. So we will. When I say a date, I don't specifically mean that specific year, because it's sort of hazy, as we know. But let's say with a four-year range of 540 or 536. Now, related to exactly to the term third year of Cyrus, if you look at chapter 1, verse 21, there it states that Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus. So the question is, does the word continue mean died, or does it mean just continue in another different manner or in a different way? So two views can sort of be determined as to which way you want to go, really. So first view, if you take the words literally, and the third year of Cyrus is actually the third year of Cyrus, then the word continued there cannot be died, because, again, of the first year, I guess, in chapter 1, that word continued cannot be died, because then he would not be in the third year of Cyrus. So either he continued in a different way than dying, or if he did die, then now then you have to reconcile chapter 1 with chapter 3, or chapter 10 here. So the other way to interpret it is that the third year of Cyrus could be in which he reigned alongside or with, or co-region with, as I think, but I think Ben brought out, related to Belshazzar and Nabonidus. So if you have him as co-region with Darius for 3 years, then you have him 3 years reign with him, and in the first year of reign as sole king. And I tend to go in that direction. In fact, there's probably some evidence to suggest that the third year of Cyrus is really the same as the first year of Cyrus, except for the fact that, again, he's reigning alone now in relation to the kingdom, and not reigning with Darius, or co-reigning. So I tend to go in that direction. So let's say it's 540, and that the continued in chapter 1 is dying. So that means that Daniel would die this year. Oh, in verse 1 also, it mentions Belteshazzar and says Daniel, whose name was also Belteshazzar. And I believe there's just mentioned here to relate the Daniel that is now to that Daniel that was taken captive in Nebuchadnezzar's reign, which we're talking about a 70-year period. So it's, again, Daniel's reputation and Daniel's example would be needed to, again, just relate that to the fact that Daniel and Belteshazzar are the same person. And then it says the time appointed was long. And there's not really a very accurate translation. I think a better translation, I think most other versions of the English Standard, American Standard, will have it, that is the prophecy, and we're talking about the prophecy in chapter 11, is about a great calamity. It's probably more accurate. The prophecy is about a great calamity, or it is a long, calamitous warfare. And then it says, states, I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplications with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And we'll take a little time to consider that. I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplications with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. Again, this is related to prayer. And I think we've learned that Daniel was expecting the Jews to be returning to the land because of Jeremiah's prophecy. And yet he still does this. And I want to stress the point as much as I can, related to prayer and how much we do of it and how intense we have the prayers that we do make. There's a quote from the Christadelphian, and this is from the year 2000, but I believe it's also a reprint of an old Berean. Regardless of the fact, it's very clear and point into the point. And again, I will try to stress as much as I can the words to give you an impression of what it says here. This is related to the prayer and so on. A few minutes' reflection on this will serve to make us ashamed of many of our efforts in prayer. Perhaps in a family emergency or a critical illness, we share something of this agonizing intensity. Of this agonizing intensity, or know of those who have been so torn. But here Daniel does not stand to benefit personally. Rather, he becomes the voice of the covenant people. In his own person, he was already well on in his 80s, and it was highly unlikely that he would share actively in the joy of the return apart from living to hear the proclamation of Cyrus. But Daniel so merges himself with his people that he identifies himself with national sin, rebellion, and hardness of heart. So, and the words he uses are, we have sinned. We have not hearkened. And I don't think any of us have ever put ourselves in dust and ashes, have we? But the strength of the prayers, the intensity of them, is something that we need to make sure to get to or attain to. And I don't think we can ever do that unless we get into a closet and pray for ourselves, by ourselves. Now let's look at verses 2 and 3. Daniel takes it upon himself to go beyond what the law of the Passover required. And the Passover law is found in Exodus 12. That required that no unleavened bread was to be eaten from the 14th to the 21st day of the first month. And we get from verse 4 that this actually is the first month. But he starts on the first day, not the 14th day. So from the first day to the 21st day, he fasts. He drinks no meat, eats no meat, has no pleasant bread, nor does he drink wine. So he's fasting for 3 full weeks. Now, whether he's still fasting on the 24th day is a matter of conjecture. Possibly he stopped and thinks that deity has not heard him. Or perhaps he believes deity has heard him but will answer the prayer in another time or manner. Or perhaps he still is fasting on the 24th day. Either way, deity actually knew of Daniel's intention and great attitude toward Yahweh and his fellow countrymen. Because the angel says, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that thou set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words." Now let's look at verses 4 through 7. On the 24th day of the month, he is by the Hiddekel, or the Tigris River. And he sees a vision. Now it is clear that this vision is not just in his mind. And that's the impression, I think, that we get from the word, "Well, I saw a vision." Because of those who were with him, even though they did not see the vision or the image of the spiritual man, still they knew something awesome was present. So in our vernacular, we'll probably say Daniel had a great spectacle or a sight to behold. So it was not just in his mind. Then the man of the one, or the certain man, I think it's the King James, is mentioned, or described actually. And I want to relate that, this perfect man, or the certain man here, to the Son of Man that is mentioned in chapter 1 of Revelation, and also the living creatures that Ezekiel saw in chapter 1. So I will relate each of the points that I saw a similarity between these three images. So this certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz, as it says in verse 5. Switch over to Revelation. There it says, this Son of Man was girt about the paps or the chest with a golden girdle. And then you switch over to Ezekiel. Out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, which amber being gold and silver. That's from chapter 1, verse 4. Back to Son of Man, the third man in Daniel. His body was like the barrel. Now, there's no image related to the barrel, B-E-R-Y, B-E-R-Y-L, in the Son of Man in Revelation. But in Ezekiel, living creatures, the appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a barrel. Verse 16. Here in chapter 10, his eyes as lamps of fire. Son of Man in Revelation, his eyes were like a flame of fire. Verse 14. the Ezekiel living creatures, as for living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. Verse 13. Son of man, his arms and his feet like the color to polished brass. Son of man of Revelation, his feet were like fine brass refined in a furnace. Ezekiel's living creatures, their legs were straight and they sparkled like burnished brass. Son of man, the third man in Daniel, the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. Verse 7. His voice was like that of like the roar of many waters. Verse 15 of Revelation, Son of Man. And then Ezekiel's living creatures, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, as the noise of an host. And lastly, in Daniel's third man, and his face was as the appearance of lightning. Verse 6. Now, I did not see anything related to lightning in John, Son of Man. There was something in Ezekiel's living creatures, and his face as the appearance of lightning. Verse 6 of chapter 1. And then just an interesting point that I seem to have just occurred to me as I was going through comparisons of these. Daniel, son of man, has two things that the other two do not. That is, the hairs of their head were white like snow, and the sword proceeds out of the son of man in Revelation, but not in the other two. Now let's look real quick at verses 8 through 11. Upon seeing the vision, Daniel goes through a typical or a type of resurrection. Eventually, he is made strong to stand with the angel and talk with him. Now, there is some debate whether the man that touched Daniel is a certain man that we just described in these previous verses, or whether it is Gabriel, because it just really says the pronoun he. So, it's different from the vision, or the Son of Man, Gabriel is. So, which one is which, it's sort of, you know, have to read the chapter and kind of try to determine which one's which. But I believe Gabriel is there as well. He's the one that, as the thing it says towards the last verse of the chapter, the ones that make him known the prophecy of chapter 11. So I think it is Gabriel that touches Daniel. And it is he who revealed to him the prophecy of the next chapter, as I mentioned. So Gabriel begins in verse 11. He said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright. For unto thee am I now sent. And we had spoken these words unto me, I stood trembling. Now verses 12 and 13. Gabriel now explains to Daniel that deity has sent him. And he has sent him to answer Daniel's prayer, again, from the first day that he began to fast, on the first day of the month. But 24 days later, that's when Gabriel comes to him. And he is delayed by the prince of Persia. So the question arises, how can a prince or king of Persia, who is merely a man, delay an angel? Even to the point of requiring assistance from another angel that we understand is the archangel, as verse 13 states. Well, again, these verses give us an insight into the very complicated, and I should say very, very, very complicated, ways of providence in relation to free will. And we need to stop and to ponder the workings of deity by the information that we have been given in all the scriptures of truth. Further, we should be truly appreciating the work, the great work of the angels in conducting the affairs of providence. In order to do that, we've got to be able to stop and just think of all the intricacies that go on in our lives in relation to each other and those around us who work and everywhere else we can come up with. I don't believe we consider this enough. And I think just considering a small portion would really expand our appreciation of what the angels do And then we can go from there into just come up with some questions that hopefully will not that they have to be answered now, but at least give us some idea or some impression of what we should be doing or thinking about. Now, real briefly, and I think maybe Brother Matthew covered some of these related to the angels, but just some points that I had already, so I'm not going to change them. Related to angels, we know that angels are not omniscient. They're not omniscient, or then they are not omnipotent. Peter tells us that the angels desire to look into the time of Christ, from 1 Peter 1:12. Nor did they know that when was the destruction or the restoration. I couldn't decipher which one out of the Matthew 24 Mount Olivet prophecy. But Christ says there, "But of that day and that hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father." So there are some things that they do not know. We also know that there are ranks among the angels, and we get this, I think, from Jude. We call Michael an archangel. And I think Matthew brought out what was spoken by Gabriel to Zacharias, John the Baptist's father, when he tells him, "I am Gabriel that stand in the presence of God, and am sent to speak unto thee and to show thee these things." And in doing so, it seems like he was, in essence, denoting his special position in relation to the angels. Now, just a couple of questions to consider. And again, it depends on time, and we don't have to answer them. But just something to consider. How was it that Jacob had power over an angel when he wrestled with him, unless the angel allowed himself to be kept till the morning as a sign that Jacob had power with God? How is it that Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and we're talking about providence, considering the concept of free will? The deity literally harden his heart. If so, does that not violate the concept that each one of us has a free will to obey or to disobey? Perhaps deity could easily predict what Pharaoh would do as a consequence of the miracles that he was seeing and experiencing, and also of Moses' words to him that perhaps sometimes were a little maybe harsh or would really violate his pride or prick his pride. How is it that Yahweh tells Moses that he, that is Yahweh, will send an angel with the Israelites, but that he, Yahweh, will not go because if he goes, he will destroy them? Exodus 33, verse 2 and 3. "And I will send an angel before thee, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, into a land flowing with milk and honey. For I," says the angel Yahweh, or Yahweh, "I will not go up in the midst of thee, for thou art a stiff-necked people, lest I consume thee in the way." But the angel that would go with them would not. Now, we know that an angel destroyed 185,000 in one night, in Zechariah's time. So the angel had the capability of the ability to be able to do that. But yet he would not or could not. So possibly it was a question of authority, not necessarily of capability. Another question. How is it that the angel manifesting Yahweh in the wilderness tells Moses to stand away from the Israelites because he is going to destroy them and start a new nation with Moses' offspring? Would Yahweh have done this? I personally believe he would have. Some may think he would not. Apparently this angel, or manifestation of Yahweh, which probably was, by the way, just a side note, probably this angel Michael that we're talking about in chapter 10, did have the authority to be able to do this. He says in Exodus 32:10, again, every one of us can decide for ourselves. "And the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, and that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation." We know and understand that none of us are forced. Okay, right? None of us are forced to act in a certain way by God. It is our choice. And we also know that deity does not tempt us by actually putting an evil thought into our mind. It all comes from our sinful thoughts, our sinful nature. So he neither forces a king, and let's say it's Cyrus, here in King of Persia. He neither forces the king to sign a document. He doesn't literally take his hand and force him to sign a document. However, through providence, he could limit the choices of the king by manipulating the circumstances around him to the point of where the king has no choice, in essence, by signing that document. Maybe he will retain his throne by signing it. Or maybe he has pressure from his noblemen to sign it. Whichever way, there are so many ways that God, the angels, can manipulate certain circumstances around men, especially, as we know, natural men or natural thinking men. It is a great exercise for us to stop and to consider those ways of providence, or how the angels are in the background directing matters in a certain direction. Within deity's timetable and plan, we're in some things that are inflexible. Certain things are inflexible. We covered, these are erased now, covered the timetables or times. Those are inflexible. They're time. There's why they're really given 2300 days or 2400 if you want to go, or the time times and dividing of time, 42 months. All those are times that are fixed. But there are other things around that are not so fixed. They're flexible. They have some flexibility. And that's where providence comes in. So is everything in our lives meant to be? I think Brother Roberts covers this in Ways of Providence. Is everything in our lives meant to be? Am I meant to be here speaking to you today? I don't think it is that detailed to where every little thing that we do in our lives is mapped out. There's some flexibility. There's some things that can change. We can change them based on our decisions. The angels work with us. They teach us. They guide us. They protect us. Yet, they allow us to fall. Then what do we allow? They allow us to fall to teach us. They allow us to be driving down the road and having a car accident, if that's what their decision was to do, for whatever reason. So maybe through that car accident, we will learn something. So, but we would be spared. If we have cars, perhaps we will be spared. But what if it is time for us to die? Then we will die. Now, we covered considered the three young men, in which they said, as I think was brought out, "Be it so. We do not know whether God will rescue us. But whichever way it will go, it will be His will." So we are learning, progressing, hopefully, maturing. And within all these ways of providence, things happen for a reason. But I also believe we can go against providence. We can go against and, in essence, affect a plan that may have to be worked around us. Consider Daniel, consider Hezekiah. He had 15 years to live extra or added to his planned life, apparently. perhaps deity wanted to prove him further, one more step. Yet deity could foresee, in his wisdom and his providence and omniscience, that Hezekiah in those 15 extra years was not going to affect those fixed points in his plan. Those parameters are set. So within those 15 years, he had a choice. Now I think in foresight, we learned he failed in certain ways. But he was given 15 years. So he affected his own plan. Now again, whether he's, there's not much for us to tell, I'm not even getting into judging him. But we have a record that he did do something that was not recommended. So, let's consider again, free will, providence, and the angels working within all these things. And it's a fabric, it's a tapestry that just is great to appreciate. Something to consider. And I cannot help but to mention that we have that opportunity to be part of that process in which we will be dealing with people that may have, in the kingdom for instance, teaching them. But working in the background, what the angels do now for us, we will do for them. And maybe even beyond that. So it is, I guess, unspeakable, I think, as Paul says, the reward that is promised to those that love God. Verses 14 through 18, real quick. I'm probably passing time here. It says, "I can make you understand what is to happen in your what is to happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision is for days yet to come." English Standard Version. Apparently, due to the words spoken by Gabriel in verse 13, Daniel again feels weak, and he falls to the ground and is mute. So a hand touches his lips, probably Gabriel again, and Daniel is able to talk with him about the vision. Verse 19: "O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be unto thee. Be strong. Yea, be strong." Then Gabriel states in verse 20 of the, and I'll use the English Standard Version here for a little more clarity. "Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends with," and I think it should be "by my side. There is none who contends with me or by my side against these except Michael, your prince." Now this verse seems to suggest, to indicate that this angel, which again, his name is Gabriel, was working to support Israel in the providence of getting Persia through its first king, Cyrus, perhaps, to help the Jews. Now perhaps if the first year of Cyrus is the third year, as I would tend to believe, perhaps the withstanding that is mentioned in this chapter of the angel by the king of Persia was the letting of the Jews back into the land. Because Ezra tells us this in first chapter. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Yahweh might, by the mouth of Jeremiah, might be fulfilled, the Lord, and it says, stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, "Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem," which is in Judah. "Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him. And let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord, Lord God of Israel. He is the God which is in Jerusalem." In addition, Gabriel seems to state that when the Persian Empire is defeated by the Greeks, and we're talking about 200 years later, so for 200 years, Gabriel at least is going to be dealing with the kings of Persia. And when the kings of Persia, they're defeated by the Greeks, under Alexander, then Gabriel will deal with those kings of Greece and will work providentially, probably in government, or with, you know, again, providence, to help the Jews. If so, we can surmise that this went on after the Greeks into the Roman times. And, you know, just to give ourselves a little impression of the fact that it was 500 years from the time that Gabriel appears in this chapter to the time he appears to Zechariah and then to Mary. So for 500 years, Gabriel had been dealing with, with providence, helping the Jews, or protecting them, or maybe at times hurting them, because they were punished very severely. And lastly, it seems to me that the first verse of chapter 11 should actually be the last verse of chapter 10, in which Gabriel tells Daniel that he, Gabriel, stood with the Persian king Darius, which we've mentioned, I think it's mentioned in chapter 5 and 9, to confirm providentially Darius as king. Once Gabriel establishes this point, he begins his prophetic discourse of what is truth related to Israel and the kingdoms that will rule over the land until the return of Christ.
To thank Brother Joel for those remarks this morning. It's interesting as we move on through this book that we find how it ties back together. Now we're back to Darius, but yet it shadows forward the history and what will follow. Now open this assembly for comments by the brethren. Brother Jim Somerville.
Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, it's an interesting concept that Joel mentioned, the concept of free will, of providence, and of the interworking of the angels. James tells us that the fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. And he uses Elijah as the example. But here's another example. Joel finished with the first verse of the next chapter. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. If we remember in our last chapter, the ninth chapter, that was the fervent prayer of Daniel in the first year of Darius. You have Daniel, as has been said, has been taken captive. He's been in captivity for 68 years. He knows that the time was to be 70 years, and in the 68th year, Babylon falls. And how do we see Daniel? We see Daniel in fervent prayer for his nation, confessing the sins of the people and praying for them to come back to their land. And that didn't happen. It was 2 years early. And yet he's told that at that time, I started working on this project. I was working with Darius to bring about what you ask. And here it is 2 years later, Jeremiah saw no signs of Babylon allowing the restoration to the land. Now it's 70 years. It's the first month, the month of the Passover, when Moses delivered the people out of Egypt. And what do we see, Daniel? Once again, prostrate in prayer, eating nothing, drinking only water, praying for the deliverance of his people. And we're told that in the first day when he began to pray, the angel started working on it, but that the prince of Persia withstood him 21 days. And so here's Daniel, 21 days in prayer, not seeing behind the scenes. The angel heard that prayer, and the angel started working on the project. But it took 21 days for the angel to bring about the situation where he could finally be freed up and come to Daniel and explain the things that Daniel needed to know. And we see Daniel here is 90 years old. And sometimes you see the older brethren and sisters, well, I'm too old, what can I do? I'm weak, I'm not got the physical power anymore. Neither did Daniel. He's 90 years old. And yet, the fervent prayer of the righteous man availed much. Although, during his prayer, he didn't see it. It reminds me, Joel mentioned Zechariah also in the New Testament when Gabriel appears to him. And what does Gabriel say to this man that's well stricken in age? Your prayer is heard, you're going to have a son. Zechariah didn't believe that. He wasn't there praying for a son. It's too late. He probably prayed for that 40 years before that, 50 years before that. Now, he didn't expect to have a son. And Gabriel says, I heard your prayer. God doesn't work on our timetable. And we've got to keep that in mind. It's not that he doesn't hear our prayer. If we're fervent in it, and if we're faithful in it, he does. And we can be rest assured, as we were shown last night, that the angel of God encamps about those that fear him.
Brother Philip?
I'd like to thank Brother Joel for the very interesting way that he dealt with Daniel chapter 10. As Brother Jim just said, it's very thought-provoking to consider the circumstances, because we think of these things in relation to our own lives. Brother Joel asked a number of questions during his talk, and I must admit I don't quite recall all of them. But the one he said with regards to Pharaoh, and free will and the working out of the purpose of God, I think sometimes when we think very deeply upon these things, sometimes we can go around in circles and we start wondering where one ends, where the other begins, and things like that. But the thing with Pharaoh, and it may be an illustration which may serve to assist our understanding in all sorts of circumstances, is the analogy of clay and wax. If we had a lump of clay and we had a lump of wax, and we took them outside there and placed them on the stone and left them there for a period of time, there's one thing that will operate upon the clay and the wax, and that's the sun with its intense heat. We could go back there after a little while, and we find that the wax is completely melted, and it's quite malleable, and we find that the clay has gone quite hard. Yet it's the same sun, it's the same set of circumstances that operate for both of those different constitutions. And I see Pharaoh in that way, and we are all in that way. We've all got an individual constitution, if you like. Not that we're predetermined, I'm not suggesting we've got a Calvinistic outline in any shape or form, but the same set of circumstances can act upon us in different ways. What we have to ensure is that we are like the clay in the potter's hand, and that we are malleable, and that we are moulded into the purpose of God. We still have our free will, and something that will happen in our lives may well harden us, and it may soften us as well. We have to ensure that these things soften us, that the power of the Word of God changes the chemical constitution, as it were, so that we are in harmony with the divine purpose. The point I'd like to comment more specifically in the book of Daniel is the type that Brother Thomas brings out in Anastasis with regards to this typical death and resurrection of Daniel. We know that John in Patmos experienced the same. Zechariah also had the same symbolical death state and resurrection. And the point I'd like to draw attention to, Brother Thomas picks on verses 10, 11, and 18, to show the principles of anastasis, which in the Greek means a standing up. There's the awakening in verse 10, and the standing upright in verse 11, finally made strong in verse 18 in the gift of immortality. But without going into those particular details, the thing that always strikes me in Daniel is the judgment seat. In this 10th chapter, the actual judgment seat. When we read those verses there, Daniel was dumb. It says at the end of verse 11, he stood trembling. He'd been in this deep sleep, symbolical of death, and now he stands, he's been awakened, just like the dead will arise and stand before the Son of Man, just as we will be taken and stand before the Son of Man, and we will stand there. And when it's on those occasions when we think about the judgment seat, we think, how are we going to give an account? How are we going to stand? When we are asked questions, we might very well feel, even now in prospect of that thought, as if we'd be dumb. Where would we start? Would we be trembling? I suggest we would be really fearful, and just because of the awesome presence of the deity at that time. And I think the key of it is in verse 16, "Behold, one like the similitude of the sons of man touched my lips, then I opened my mouth and spake." All through our probationary lives in the truth, we're absorbing those circumstances we talked about earlier. We're developing characters. We're responding, we're reacting, we're acting to a whole set of circumstances. We may be putting into our minds right things. We may be putting into our minds wrong things. And it's difficult to be able sometimes to give an account. But I believe, and this is just a suggestion, that at the day of judgment, we won't have any difficulty whatsoever in providing account of our stewardship. Because in the symbol, that one like unto the similitude of the sons of man will touch our lips, as it were. And we'll be able to give an assessment of our conduct. We will be able, we won't be there as we use an expression sometimes in the UK, gibbering idiots, that we can't even frame our words and what we want to say. We'll be able to say it. The power of the deity will so act upon us, in whichever way that is, that we'll be able to give an honest account of our stewardship before the Son of Man. True, it's a suggestion, but it's one that we might want to think about in relation to the judgment that we have, that's coming upon us very soon.
Brother Gary.
Concerning Pharaoh and God hardening his heart, when I was principal at school, there were all these certain kids that would get in trouble. And I'd always tell them that you are so predictable. Same ones, certain kids would do something or something would happen that would cause them to get in trouble. And I would tell them they were so predictable. I knew exactly what was going to happen. So it's sort of like Pharaoh. I think the way God hardened his heart, he knew kind of what kind of person he was. He was so predictable in that things could happen, and then he would react accordingly.
I think probably all parents have felt that. Our kids at the age of, who knows, know what buttons to push, and it becomes an art form as such, and as they grow older it becomes a game basically. But we read in Daniel earlier about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The princes knew what button to push, and then in chapter 6 they tried to push that same button, but it was a different king. They hadn't had time to find out what his buttons were, so when they tried the same button, it didn't work. But it's interesting. It's human nature. We all have our buttons to push, and that, I think, is our trial. You know, if we can turn off our buttons, we will be more open to understand what's going on. And I think what Daniel saw so much and understood so much that, you know, it troubled him. And in his prayer that we had last night, he was basically praying not for himself, he was praying for his people. It was all they. You know, he was included in it, but it was they. And there was no self in that, which was interesting. Any other comments? Brother Jim?
Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, I absolutely agree with what Brother Phillips said and what Brother Gary said, except I'll take it further. I feel very strongly that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And the reason I feel that way, I feel, first of all, he was the material, as Brother Phil said, or as Brother Gary said, you know the person. And we're told that. For this cause I have raised thee up, that I might show forth my power. So God picked the guy that he knew was going to be rebellious. But the first few times it says, and Pharaoh hardened his heart. But then when, as the accounts go on, it says, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And I think you come to a point where God says, if that's what you want, here, I'll help you. God, we're told, gave Israel statutes that were not good. What's that mean? He gave them laws that were bad? Yeah, because they didn't want his laws. They turned their back on his laws. They wanted these other laws. So he's fine. That's what you want? Here, have at it. And brothers and sisters, the warning to us is the same thing. Even as they would not retain God in their memory, God gave them up to a reprobate mind. If we do not strive to seek God's will, if we do not, we'll fail, but we need to turn it around and strive again. And there comes a point where we're not striving, that we're not trying, we're in trouble. Because God is liable to turn us over to our reprobate mind, to give us a strong delusion that we can believe a lie. And we see it happen in these brethren and sisters that go off. They're convinced in their own mind that they want nothing to do with the truth. God will do that for us or to us if we do not retain him in our memory. And Pharaoh refused after being shown clearly that Yahweh was the God of Israel. He still turned against them. And so God then hardened his heart to prove to the rest of Israel that he indeed was God.
One more comment. Brother Sid?
And Brother Joel asked a question about the instance where God said he would not go amongst them but would send his angel, lest if he went amongst them he would destroy them. And you know, to suggest that God couldn't go amongst them without destroying them would be to suggest that God would lose control of himself, which is not a proper suggestion. So it looks to me, just in the short time I've had to think about this, that this was a means of communication, and God employs many means of communication and signification, and what he was doing was signifying the intensity of his displeasure by telling them, I don't feel like I should come among you. I better send somebody lesser, because right now I could just step on you like a bug. And even though he had no intention of doing that, and having no intention of doing that, he would not do it if he went amongst them, he always signaled his displeasure with people all down through the ages by withdrawing his presence, withdrawing his support, withdrawing his help, as Brother Jim said, abandoning them to their own desires. And he's saying here, I'm so angry with you, I could just destroy you. I won't do it. But that's how I feel. And that's something that's a really good message for us to think about. How does what we do make God feel? Moses and Abraham and and Daniel were described as beloved friends of Yahweh. They cared about how he felt. And as humans, our own care about how we feel looms pretty large sometimes and tends to eclipse how we should be telling God we feel about him.